from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Jim Bill Lynn claims he was fired from Walmart for reporting on working conditions in Central American factories, when in fact that's what he was sent there to do.
James William Lynn was terminated for identifying and specifying to Walmart that the South American facilities had abysmal working conditions as a result of him telling Walmart that they had to get rid of him.
A Walmart whistleblower is fired for speaking out against the company's labor practices in Central America, he says. He's suing the retail giant. We'll speak with his attorney as well as a Walmart spokesperson. Then the Senate passes the Central America Free Trade Agreement. We'll take a look at how the Labor Department tried to block the release of a government-funded study that criticized labor standards in Central America.
We are releasing new reports on labor rights violations in Central America that show that CAFTA has not made any difference in these workers' lives.
And as millions of Americans get ready for burger cookouts this 4th of July weekend, people may want to think twice about their meat. The first American-born mad cow is discovered in Texas. But first, a cop is shot in Queens and the police round up 180 black men in response. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. In Iraq, the country's interior minister is estimating nearly 8,200 Iraqis have been killed over the past 6 months from attacks carried out by the Iraqi resistance. An average of 45 Iraqis are being killed each day. The minister estimated another 12,000 Iraqis have been injured. Meanwhile, Baghdad's mayor is threatening to resign if the government fails to provide the funds needed to implement development projects in the capital. The mayor, Ala Mahmoud al-Tamimi, complained the capital is suffering from constant water shortages. Earlier this month, a rocket attack on a water pipeline near Baghdad left millions without enough water. And the U.S. death toll in Iraq for the month of June is now at least 68, making it the military's deadliest month so far this year. More than half the deaths occurred in the Anbar province near Fallujah. USA Today's reporting U.S. military deaths in Iraq increased by about a third in the past year. At least 882 U.S. troops have died. Meanwhile, a group of Senate Republicans have begun blaming the news media for the military's recruiting problems. Senator James Inhofe said families are discouraging young men and women from enlisting, quote, because of all the negative media that's out there. Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas added, quote, with the deluge of negative news that we get daily, it's just amazing to me anybody would want to sign up, he said. The Army's 14% short of its annual target of new recruits. It missed its monthly goals in February, March, April, and May. The Army did reach its goal for June, but that was only because the goal was lower than any other of the year. A new Zogby poll shows that 42% of voters believe Congress should impeach President Bush if it's found he didn't tell the truth about his reasons for going to war with Iraq. While Democrats disproportionately favored impeachment, the poll found a quarter of Republicans would back the measure if it's determined Bush lied about Iraq. Calls for impeachments have increased since the Sunday Times of London published what's now known as the Downing Street Memo. The memo from the summer of 2002 outlined the Bush administration's position on Iraq. It said the invasion of Iraq was inevitable and that, quote, the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. In related news, 52 members of the House have filed a Freedom of Information Act request seeking more documents related to the Downing Street minutes. On to the case of Judith Miller and Matthew Cooper, the two reporters who are potentially facing jail time for refusing to reveal their sources to the government in the case of outed CIA operative Valerie Plame. On Thursday, Cooper's employer, Time Magazine, announced it will hand over copies of Cooper's notes. Time Inc.'s editor-in-chief, Norman Perlstein, said, quote, I found myself really coming to the conclusion that once the Supreme Court has spoken, we're not above the law and we have to behave the way ordinary citizens do, he said. The decision is not sitting well with others involved. Cooper himself says he disagrees with Time's decision. The New York Times, which employs Judith Miller, said it too was deeply disappointed. Legal experts said they knew of no other instance in modern journalistic history in which a major news organization announced it'll disclose the identities of its confidential sources in response to a government subpoena. Miller and Cooper could both still face jail time. On Wednesday, a federal judge says he'll order the reporters jailed for up to 120 days if they don't agree to testify before the grand jury. In California, a federal judge ruled Thursday the state's prison health care system must be placed under the oversight of a federal receiver because the system is in such a state of disarray. U.S. District Judge Thelton Henderson said he is shocked to learn that an average of one prisoner needlessly dies each week in California because of medical incompetence or neglect. Under the court order, the receiver will report directly to the judge and will be empowered to order fixes to the prison system. On Capitol Hill, the Senate's passed CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, by 54-45 vote. 10 Democrats voted for the trade pact, while 11 Republicans voted against it. The House is expected to vote on CAFTA later this month. In Canada, attorneys for Maher Arar are now saying that criminal charges should be brought against the U.S. agents who helped to secretly send him to Syria in 2002. Arar is a Syrian-born Canadian citizen who was seized by U.S. officials during a stopover at JFK Airport. He was detained briefly in the U.S., then flown to Jordan, then driven to Syria. He was held in a coffin-like cell for nearly a year and reportedly tortured. Charges were never filed against him. Arar was the first known foreigner to be a victim of the U.S. practice known as extraordinary rendition. Last week in Italy, a judge ordered the arrest of 13 CIA agents for taking part in a rendition in Milan. The judge likened the practice of rendition to kidnapping. The Nation magazine's reporting that Harvard law professor and free speech expert Alan Dershowitz has written a letter to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to quash a book about to be published by the University of California Press. The book is by scholar Norman Finkelstein. It's called Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of antisemitism and the abuse of history. It expands on a debate Finkelstein and Dershowitz had on Democracy Now 2 years ago, where Finkelstein charged Dershowitz had misrepresented Israel's human rights record and engaged in plagiarism. Dershowitz denied the charges. The issue is gaining momentum with the release of an open letter by University of California Berkeley professor Bashara Dumani urging the UC Press to ignore Dershowitz's threats and publish the book in its agreed-upon form. In The Nation magazine, Schwarzenegger's legal advisor is quoted saying the governor will not intervene in issues of academic freedom. In Minnesota, the state's government has shut down for the first time ever over a budget dispute. Under a court order, essential services must still be provided, but some 9,000 state workers temporarily have no work. In Los Angeles, the city's new mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, is being sworn in today. A son of a Mexican immigrant, Villaraigosa is the city's first Latino mayor in over a century. He defeated the incumbent, Mayor Jim Hahn, in May's election. And this news from Mexico. The Zapatista rebel army pledged Thursday to build a political alliance of the left. They plan to send a delegation on a nationwide tour to drum up support ahead of next year's presidential race. The Zapatistas, however, said they would stay out of electoral politics because, quote, we already know all candidates are neoliberals, they said. The group said they would push for a new constitution that, quote, recognizes the rights and liberties of the people and defends the weak against the powerful. The announcement came a week after the rebels declared a red alert to hold high-level internal discussions about the future of their movement, and 3 days after they said they would seek to move toward politics and away from armed conflict. And those are some of the headlines. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you out there in broadcast land and listening into Democracy Now! On the Internet. We begin today with a case of a police dragnet in New York City, one that I wrote about in yesterday's Daily News. On June 14th, Officer Christopher Wisniewski of Queens was shot in the leg with his own gun while trying to arrest a man allegedly smoking marijuana. During the next 3 days, police mounted a massive dragnet in the community. A total of 181 black men in the Queens neighborhood of Cambria Heights and Laurelton were arrested on misdemeanor charges and quality of life violations. Some who were arrested report that they were grabbed by the cops, handcuffed, and not giving any explanations at the time of their arrest. The police department and Mayor Bloomberg have remained silent on the matter, despite calls from City Councilman Leroy Comrie, Queens Representative Gregory Meeks, and Democratic mayoral candidate Fernando Ferrer to give an explanation for the cops' behavior. We're joined in the studio by Mark Claxton. He's a retired New York police detective, is a resident of the neighborhood, and is a member of the group 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. Claxton is spearheading the efforts to file a lawsuit against the NYPD on this matter. Mark Claxton.
Thanks for having me.
Talk a little bit about the incident and how you became involved in it and what the reaction has been in the community.
As you indicated, on the 14th, there was a police officer who alleged that he was shot by a young male black. We became involved with it when we received several calls to our hotline number from some of the individuals who had been stopped, detained, searched, and or arrested. So we contacted several people, and we found a disturbing pattern that really yells racial profiling. And when you look at the numbers that you mentioned, it's clearly an indication that there is some systematic mass arrest initiative that occurred out in Queens. And our questions are, what's the justification for it?
Can you describe what 180 black men arrested?
That's off the charts. I mean, and if you believe those numbers, we happen to believe that the numbers are actually higher than that. It's a very disturbing set of circumstances. And those numbers for a police precinct are really off the charts. On the first day, it's reported that there were over 93 arrests. That's just arrests. Who knows how many summonses and stop and frisks occurred in addition to that?
On what grounds?
That's a good question. I attended a community meeting last Wednesday, and the executive officer of the precinct pretty much established that this is what occurs after a police shooting. Now, in my 20 years of police experience, extensive detective investigative experience, that is not what occurs. It appears that in the white communities, when there is an incident such as this, the police will go door to door and ask questions. In the black community, what they engage in is mass arrest, which lead to interrogation and interviews.
And for our national audience who may not know the Cambria, Laurelton section of Queens, I mean, that's essentially a very middle-class neighborhood. It's not one that has a high crime rate to begin with, right?
Right. It's a solid working-class, middle-class, primarily black community. It's a very quiet community. It's a very engaging and homey kind of community. It's not in any way considered the deep inner city. So you have a hard-working class out there. And it's a largely Caribbean community as well. And that's Cambria Heights, Queens Village, Laurelton, Rosedale. That's southeast Queens corridor.
Juan, you describe some of the people you talked to, some of the people who were arrested.
Yes, I talked to several young men all in their early 20s who were just standing out on a street corner about 2:30 in the afternoon talking to two groups of young men when suddenly police plainclothesmen came up, guns drawn, threw them all on the ground, handcuffed them all, wouldn't tell them why they were being arrested or anything, and they ended up spending 24 hours through the system. Eventually, they found out they were being charged with disorderly conduct, but then when they got before a judge, all the charges were dropped, and they were all marked for what's called ACD, a German contemplating dismissal. I'm trying right now to find out exactly how many of those people who were arrested, and this is all on minor misdemeanor charges, from urinating, driving without a license, having alcohol in the street, how many of them were actually just dropped when they came before a judge, because to put that many people through the system, and many of these are actually what's called violations where you normally would get a summons.
Correct. As a matter of fact, those things that you mentioned, urinating in public, drinking, open container violations, disorderly conduct, they don't even reach the level of crime. Those are, in fact, violations of law. What occurred here is similar to, if you can imagine, driving in your car and running a red light, being pulled over by the police officer, being handcuffed, taken to the precinct, interrogated by the detectives, and taken to central booking.
And, of course, what this means when you apply for a job, for example, and says, have you ever been arrested?
Right. If you consider this in the context of the recent report regarding unemployment, particularly in the black community, and the reality of the difficulty of the job market in New York and the nation as a whole, it's very disturbing. And so many of these young men who are completely innocent, who have never had any previous police contact, now have to explain this ACD, German contemplation of dismissal, or even perhaps convictions. And it's very disturbing. It sets them up for their future. And I think it's alarmed the community out there, and we're staying vigorously involved in it.
Now, this is all happening as this hate crime has been committed that is getting a lot of attention right now. Howard Beachman, who was just arraigned and charged with first-degree assault for fracturing the skull of a man. And it turns out your paper, once again, Juan, the Daily News, is now breaking another story about this Nicholas Minucci and what he did as the World Trade Center towers were going down in 2001.
Right. There were actually three white men who supposedly attacked three black men in the Howard Beach section. Of course, Howard Beach is infamous back in nearly 20 years ago when another racial incident there that really divided the city, a similar attack on black men walking through the neighborhood. And this Mannucci apparently was arrested or had an incident on the day of September 11th, when he allegedly attacked a Sikh man with some other individuals, where they were basically attacking them, saying you F Arabs,
why don't you blow this up?
Why don't you blow this up? Right, as they were beating them. So that Mannucci apparently has a history. Also, one of the other men arrested, along with Mannucci in this latest incident, apparently is the son of a police detective. So it's not clear what the facts are around this case, except that one of the men who was badly beaten is had a fractured skull and is in stable but critical condition in the hospital.
And the man with the fractured skull is named Glenn Moore.
Right, but amazingly, I think the important thing to understand is the police department has really gone very heavily after these men, and I think they should. But at the same time, when you have an incident like what happened in Cambria Heights, which is an instance not of of a violent attack by individuals, but of a systematic attack on the black community by the police department itself, the department is not even investigating or trying to get to the bottom of what happened out there, right?
Absolutely. They seem just very reluctant to deal with this governmental violation that occurred out in this hardworking community. I think what occurred in Howard Beach may be a convenient distraction for this administration to avoid the issues such as what occurred in Cambria Heights, Queens, and the surrounding communities as well.
Well, Mark Laxton, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Retired New York police detective who is involved in spearheading efforts to file a lawsuit against, well, his own department, the New York Police Department, for
the
what happened
department.
In Queens. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now, Juan, to another story.
Yes. Well, Walmart fired an executive after he blew the whistle on factory conditions in Central America. He documented forced pregnancy tests, 24-hour work shifts, extreme heat, pat-down searches, locked exits, and other labor law violations. The corporation says it fired James Lynn for having an affair with a subordinate. Now Lynn is suing Walmart. Walmart is the largest company in the world. It employs 1.6 million people globally and deals directly with hundreds of factories throughout Latin America and Asia.
James Lynn worked at Walmart for 8 years. He was promoted from local manager to being in charge of troubleshooting for Walmart distribution centers in an entire region of the country. Then Walmart offered him a position in Costa Rica, overseeing factory certifications and quality control. At the time, Walmart directly operated more than 100 factories in the region, mostly in Honduras and Guatemala. A factory inspection report that Lynn conducted and recently provided to the National Labor Committee includes a negative evaluation of workplace environment. The report reads in part, quote, "Some exits are locked and not marked during the working hours. All exits need to be marked, unlocked, and unblocked at all times. Ventilation in the factory needs improvement." While the factory improved many of its labor practices after an initial inspection, Lynn says his supervisor in Costa Rica downplayed noncompliance. In a letter, a Walmart senior executive to a letter, Lynn alleged his supervisor, quote, pressured inspectors to pass factories that have failed final inspections.
Lynn says that factory inspections were often ineffective because managers were told about them beforehand. He told the New York Times, quote, "Some of the workers I interviewed said the factory had a general meeting the day before, and we were told you better not say anything or you're fired." We're joined now on the line from Albuquerque by James Lynn's attorney, Shane Yutz. Also on the line from Arkansas is Beth Keck, Walmart's international spokesperson.
We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Amy. This is Shane Yutz.
Shane Yutz, let's begin with you. The company says they simply fired fired James Lynn because he was having an affair with a subordinate. Your response?
Mr. Lynn was hired as the global services manager, as you indicated, and his responsibilities were to administer factory certification. It is unquestioned that he observed inadequate bathroom facilities, mandatory 24-hour shifts, terrible working conditions, mandatory pregnancy testing. And I think even Walmart would admit that within a month of reporting this information to Walmart and reporting it specifically to high-placed executives, including Mike Duke, he was terminated. And And specifically, within 8 days of sending a detailed email to Bentonville, he was terminated. So, you know, it is our position that Walmart's allegation is pure pretext. Mr. Lynn didn't follow the program and was terminated as a result.
Beth Keck, your response.
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you today. We have looked very carefully at Mr. Lynn's situation, and it's very clear that he was terminated for inappropriate contact with a woman who worked directly for him, who reported to him. We think that Mr. Lynn's approach at this point in time of saying that he was fired for talking to our senior management about the factories and the conditions there really just doesn't make common sense, because his job was actually to go and look at the factories and report back to us what the situation was. I'd like to just give you a little bit of context about the time when he went down to Costa Rica.
Beth Keck, I'm going to ask you to hold that description for 1 minute. We're going to break, and then we'll come back to this discussion about Walmart. Whistleblower or fired for fair reasons. That's coming up here on Democracy Now! We're joined by Beth Keck, international spokesperson for Walmart, as well as the attorney for James Lynn, Shane Utes. Stay with us.
Esta pobre que estás com palmos medida é a conta menor. Tiraste em vida, é a conta menor que tiraste em vida. É de bom tamanho, nem largo nem fundo. É a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio. É a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio. Não é cova grande, é cova medida. É a terra que querias ver dividida. É a terra que querias ver dividida. É uma cova grande pra teu pouco defunto, mas estarás mais ancho que estavas no mundo. Mas estarás mais ancho que estavas no mundo. É uma cova grande pra teu defunto barco, porém mais que no mundo te sentirás largo. Porém mais que no mundo te sentirás largo. É uma cova grande pra tua carne pouca, mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. Mas a terra dada não se abre a boca. É a...
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about a case of a man who's been fired by Walmart. He says he was fired for whistleblowing, for reporting on labor abuses in Central American factories, then saying he was framed by Walmart for charging that he was having an affair. Our guests are Shane Utes, the lawyer for James Lynn, and Beth Keck, spokesperson for Walmart. Beth Keck, continue.
Thank you. Well, I just want to make clear that this is not a whistleblower case because, in fact, we hired Mr. Lynn to be a whistleblower for those factories in Central America. We had just made a large investment by buying a company called Pacific Resources that had been doing buying, factory inspection, and quality inspection for us around the world and in that region. We had then assigned Mr. Lynn an important leadership role to be one of our first Walmart leaders to go down, to run that company for us in that region. And so, of course, we expected the highest standards of him, and we definitely expected him to come back and tell us what he was finding. One of the reasons that we brought this function in-house was that we felt that working through a third party, our standards that we expected of our factories was not being as rigorously implemented and executed as we felt as if we had direct control of it over a company. And so it was very clear that it was Mr. Lynn's responsibility to tell us what was going on in those factories. And he did, and we're very glad of the types of reports that he was giving back. We've gone back to the factories that he has inspected, looked at the record, and to actually see what happened. And the company did address the issues that he raised. And in fact, through being able to have direct control over our program, we've strengthened the program and continued to have improvement through the factories that we source from in that region as well as all regions around the world.
Well, Ms. Beth Keck, my understanding is, in terms of some of his allegations, that they were not only about the conditions in the factories themselves, but they were also about the process that Walmart used in determining if there were any problems. For instance, he claims that there was a set series of questions that every worker had to be asked and that the inspector could not deviate from those questions. He says that basically factories were given notice several days beforehand that the inspection was coming, so if there were any problems like with child labor or so forth, that they could prepare for them. What about these allegations about the process that Walmart uses to investigate its factories?
Well, in fact, that was the type of feedback that we were needing from him as the manager responsible for that functional area, that important function. Was the program actually sound? As we were taking it over from Pacific Resources, the company we had purchased. And what we did was not only take the feedback we received from him, but from other employees in the region. In fact, we still have employees working for Walmart today from Pacific Resources that were in this area, and they've actually been promoted. So we find it curious that this is the reason that he would raise as the reason for his termination. In fact, it was due to his inappropriate conduct with a subordinate, a woman who worked directly for him.
Shane Utes, lawyer for James Lynn, your response.
Amy and Juan, I think the important thing to remember is this. Mr. Lynn observed all of these things that he observed, including if you tested positive for pregnancy in one of these factories, you were automatically terminated. Mr. Lynn reported this information to Walmart. Walmart continued to import the materials prepared by these companies and sell them at their stores in the United States. And the other important thing to remember is the system itself was flawed, and Mr. Lynn reported that, and the system didn't change. Mr. Lynn would have to give 2 or 3 days notice before he went into a factory. And in addition, Mr. Lynn was limited to interviewing 20 employees, and if on the 18th employee he found there was something terribly wrong, by Walmart's own policy, he could not interview any additional employees.
May I please respond to this?
Yes.
Yes, okay, thank you. Mr. Lynn only worked for us for 5 months, and his job was actually to bring these to our attention. In the case of the pregnancy testing, I'd like to address each of these individually, please. The case of the pregnancy testing, on the third, in one report that we have of a factory, it's an apparel factory in Honduras. We, have the records from that time that on March 19th, 2002, and this is when Mr. Lynn was doing inspections, we did, he and his team did find pregnancy testing was being illegally conducted. They stated very clearly in the reports that they told the factory that this was not acceptable and that we, Walmart, required them to stop this practice because it was discriminatory. They then went back a month later in April, to follow up on it. We did a thorough follow-up report, then again, investigation of this factory in August, so 4 months later. And by September, they had cleared up all of these issues. And actually, our approach is not to just drop a factory because they have, unless they have very egregious violations. We've worked with nonprofit organizations on what's the best approach to deal with these problems. If you stop engaging with an organization, they're not going to stop those practices. If we keep having engagement with them and show them better ways to do business, then we tend to have very much better results, which is the case with the particular factory.
Shane Utes, your response.
You know, the portrait painted here by Ms. Keck is just is not consistent with the portrait painted by Mr. Lin. He indicates that the working conditions were commonplace in the factories that he inspected. He indicated that when he told Walmart about this, they specifically instructed him not to tell executives about it, and he also said that he was being pressured to change certification results. So to suggest that Walmart was trying to work with these companies, that's true. They were trying to work with these companies to make sure the goods got into the United States at any cost.
Ms. Keck, I'd like to ask you something doesn't jive with me with what you're saying. On the one hand, you're saying that when you see violations by these factories, that you do not cut them off, that you'd rather try to work with them to improve the situation. On the other hand, you're saying that Mr. Lin was immediately fired for the indiscretion of having a relationship with a subordinate. So, in other words, you're holding your own employees to stricter standards and immediate firing, but your suppliers, you're willing to work with them when they make mistakes and violate labor rights?
I think we have here two different issues, and I'd like to separate them out, please. With Mr. Lin, our company has, like every company, you know, a very strict ethics code, particularly in the area of fraternization, because I think we all recognize that inappropriate contact is often, you know, particularly toward, you know, it's aimed toward protecting subordinates from unwelcome advances. And I think probably through many of your shows, you know, you've seen that that's usually a precursor to other more serious issues like sexual harassment. So companies, I think, universally, you know, do not support fraternization in their organizations, and we have very strict policies about that. We are very strict about ethics within our own company, where we have, you know, direct hands, because we really think our company, you know, must have the highest, you know, the highest reputation and standards possible. And so we just have a no-tolerance policy. And when rumors of this were reported to management, they took it seriously. They investigated the situation, and in fact, when they presented the information both to Mr. Lin and his subordinate, they both admitted that this had occurred, and so we fired them in keeping with our policy. And we apply this to junior associates, we apply it to senior associates. I mean, we've had some very high-profile cases in recent months about where we've been very, you know, consistent and strict with our standards. So that's how we handled Mr. Lin. It had nothing to do with his factory certification work.
Shane Utes, final comment on this.
There was a systemic problem at Walmart in their factories in South America. You know, you have many people being pressured to modify factory certification programs, and you have abysmal working conditions. And the bottom line is that the system was designed to continue having the clothes come into America to sell at Walmart stores and not stop the flow of goods. That's what the program was about.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Beth Keck, Walmart International spokesperson, and Shane Utes, lawyer for James Lin, who has brought suit against Walmart, saying he was fired for whistleblowing for his investigations of Walmart factories in Central America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now to Liza Featherstone, author of the book Selling Women Short, the landmark battle for workers' rights at Walmart, looking at Walmart here at home. Then we'll go on to talk about CAFTA and its passage by the Senate. Liza Featherstone, your comments on Walmart here at home.
Sure. Well, sadly, the conditions that James Lin reported in the factory in Honduras have quite a few echoes here at home. James Lin reported seeing wage and hour violations. Walmart has been sued in at least 39 states for wage and hour violations here. That includes employees say they were told to clock out and keep working and not be paid for the hours they worked. Often they were locked into the stores and forbidden to leave. I believe padlocked fire exits were something also mentioned in Lynn's report. And A lack of drinkable water on the premises was also something that James Lynn observed. I heard just the other day from a Walmart worker saying that there was no drinkable water in her store, and workers were being forced to buy bottled water from Walmart out of their $8 an hour wages.
That was here in the United States.
Here in the United States. So there's really quite a lot of parallels, unfortunately.
But you know, we often talk about Walmart being the biggest company in the world, but I don't think we really grasp what that means in terms of the size of this company. I saw a recent article that said that as of 2004, Walmart was running 240 stores in Canada, 92 in Germany, 664 Walmart stores in Mexico, 54 in Puerto Rico, 145 in Brazil. Mm-hmm. What is the impact of Walmart on the general retailing business, both in the United States and around the world? What's its impact in terms of labor conditions and the treatment of workers?
The impact has been absolutely tremendous. On the one hand, it's been it's created a very competitive environment where all retailers have to try to do what Walmart does, which is bring the customer the lowest possible price, and that means the lowest possible labor costs. So not only are workers paid legally about $8 an hour or $9 an hour in the U.S., but also they break every possible labor law in order to cut corners further. They've actually also been charged with child labor violations and have recently had to settle a case with the federal government on that issue. So that is It's really been, to use a cliche, a race to the bottom.
Dukes versus Walmart. Can you explain that lawsuit?
Sure. Dukes versus Walmart is the largest civil rights class action suit in history, and that's a case representing 1.6 million women, past and present employees of Walmart, charging Walmart with sex discrimination in pay, promotions, and training at every level of the company and in every region of the company and throughout its history.
Who's Betty Dukes?
Betty Dukes is an African-American woman. She's 54 years old now, still working for Walmart. She's a greeter at Walmart, the person who says welcome to Walmart when you come in Pittsburgh, California. And her experience was she began working at Walmart in 1994 as a cashier at $5 an hour, very committed to the company. She believed she was working for a Christian company. She was excited about that. She had a great regard for the founder, Sam Walton. And what she found, though, was that she worked hard. She was promoted to customer service manager, still an hourly position. Once she got there, she found she was repeatedly denied the training that she needed, both to do her job and to advance further. And she saw that training given to men who were younger, white, and newer to the company. When she complained about that, she was demoted back to her cashier job, which offered her a lower wage and also fewer hours. So it was very hard for her to get by, and continues to be.
Where does the suit stand now?
The suit is Walmart. The suit last summer was granted certification by a federal judge, and that means that the judge ruled that it could go forward as a class action suit. Walmart has appealed that decision, but the parties may reach a settlement before Walmart's appeal is decided.
And you say that when she went to work there, she considered Walmart a Christian company. Does Walmart espouse certain religious principles to its employees or a claim that it operates under certain religious principles?
There's a lot of mythology within Walmart that is not explicitly fomented at the top levels, but is widely believed by the employees. And the notion that it's a Christian company is one of those things that Walmart strategically appeases its Christian customers and Christian constituencies often refusing to carry certain titles in its store. You know, famously, it didn't carry the John Stewart book, America the Book, because of the naked Supreme Court justices. You know, things like that.
Also, Plan B, the morning after pill.
Yes, exactly. Walmart does not carry the morning after pill. It's the only major pharmacy to flatly refuse to carry that drug. And that's, again, part of the what convinces people that, you know, that it is a Christian company. However, as people like Betty Dukes have found, if you actually believe in what are traditionally thought of Christian principles of treating people decently, you will be disappointed in Walmart.
Selling Women Short is the name of Liza Featherstone's book, The Landmark Battle for Worker Rights at Walmart. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by Congressmember Bernie Sanders and by a contractor for the Department of Labor put out a report on CAFTA, and then that report was suppressed. We'll find out why. Stay with us.
Well.
Brave and Strong by Sly and the Family Stone here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn now to another story involving labor rights and the issue of free trade, the Senate voted Thursday to approve the Central American Free Trade Agreement by a 54-45 vote. 10 Democrats voted for the trade pact. 11 Republicans voted against it. The trade agreement, known as CAFTA, would eliminate most trade restrictions between the U.S. and six Latin American countries, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Guatemala, El Salvador, and the Dominican Republic. Thursday's Senate vote set the stage for a showdown in the House, where the trade pact faces overwhelming opposition from Democrats and enough Republicans to make the outcome uncertain. The House Ways and Means Committee voted to endorse CAFTA yesterday in a 25-16 vote. The full House is expected to take it up after Congress returns from Independence Day break.
Critics of the trade agreement say it provides too little protection to U.S. sugar producers and too little enforcement of labor standards in Central American countries. Earlier this week, news emerged that as the White House was lobbying Congress to win support for CAFTA, the Labor Department tried for more than a year to block the release of reports that harshly criticized labor standards in Central America. The reports were commissioned by the Labor Department to an outside contractor, the International Labor Rights Fund. The studies concluded that several of the countries involved in CAFTA have poor working conditions and have failed to protect workers' rights. The study's conclusion contrasts with the Bush administration's arguments that Central American countries have made enough progress on such issues to warrant a free trade deal with the United States.
After the Labor Rights Fund submitted their findings, the Labor Department instructed them to remove the reports from their website, ordered them to retrieve paper copies before they became public, banned release of new information from the reports, and even told them they couldn't discuss the studies with outsiders. We called the Labor Department, asked them to join us on the show, show today, but they declined. In a statement yesterday, Dirk Philpott, a spokesperson for the department's Bureau of International Labor Affairs, said the study was, quote, rife with unsubstantiated, unverifiable claims, questionable statistical data, and biased statements of findings and conclusions. Well, we're joined right now by Bama Athreya. She's the deputy director of the International Labor Rights Fund in Washington, D.C. After Bama, we will turn to Congressmember Bernie Sanders. Bama Athreya, talk about this report, what you found, and what the Department of Labor told you to do with it.
We started doing research back in 2003 on labor laws and labor law violations throughout the Central American countries. And we found in each of the countries a pattern of systematic failure to enforce basic labor protections, including protections for minimum wages, maximum hours of overtime, protection against women to prevent them from discrimination or issues like pregnancy testing in the factories. We found that these laws were not enforced and that there were such problems with the labor ministries and the judicial systems in the Central American countries that the laws couldn't be effectively enforced. This contrasts with a story that was being told throughout the entire past couple of years by the Bush administration. As I'm sure you and your listeners know, there's been an active debate over the proposed Central America Free Trade Agreement. And within that debate, the Labor Department, I mean, not only the Labor Department, the U.S. Office of the U.S. Trade Representative has publicly argued that the very fact of CAFTA negotiations have improved labor conditions in these countries. Our evidence does not find any improvements in labor law enforcement or real protections for workers on the ground. I must say we have been critical of CAFTA because we feel it's a step backwards from existing trade agreements. People seem to forget these countries actually do trade with the United States now and are covered by unilateral trade preference programs that have labor standards that are, in our view, better than the CAFTA labor standards.
Now, let me ask you, in my travels throughout some of these Central American countries, I found that the free trade zones, as they're called in many of these countries, often have worse protections and labor conditions than the actual rest of the country. Did you find that still existing now? And in essence, CAFTA would make the rest of the countries of these nations free trade zones as well, right?
Well, I mean, I do want to say once again, we trade with these countries now. We have trade agreements with them now. And so one of the things that's been, I think, a little bit of a mischaracterization in the CAFTA debate is that the proponents of CAFTA act as though these poor countries have no right to trade with the United States unless CAFTA is passed. The very existence of the free trade zones, the existence of substantial exports from these countries to the United States show that we already trade with them, okay? So there's already trade agreements in place. And, I think we have to look at the labor... From our point of view, we want to look at the labor standards across the countries. So we weren't focused on saying, let's compare this sector with that sector. I mean, we found systematically throughout the countries serious problems with labor law enforcement, whether it be, in the maquila sector, in the banana sector, in the coffee sector. I mean, we found that it was, pretty thoroughly the case that workers in all of these sectors had no meaningful or, very little meaningful access to these laws.
Congressmember Bernie Sanders of Vermont, the fact that the International Labor Rights Fund was contracted with the Department of Labor, came up with their report, and then the DOL rejected it and said they are to remove it from their website, not talk about it with outsiders. What about this?
Well, I think that's what we expect of the Bush administration. They don't play by the rules. If there are developments that take place that these guys don't like, they fight them. In this case, there was a report which came out which put a lie to everything that they're saying about CAFTA, so obviously what you do is suppress the report. Nothing new about that. The bottom line here, even before we get into all of the details of CAFTA, is that our entire trade policy, whether it's NAFTA, whether it's permanent normal trade relations with China, has been an absolute disaster. In this case, it will be, in my view, a disaster for the people of Central America, but it's also a disaster for the people of the United States of America. Amy and Juan, what all of these agreements are about is the effort of corporate America to force American workers to compete against people who make desperately low wages, to continue the race to the bottom, to drive wages down in the United States, to continue to transfer manufacturing plants from the United States to developing countries. And that's what these agreements are about, which are supported by virtually every large corporation in the country.
And your sense of the prospects for this, for CAFTA now in the House?
Well, the good news, I think, is that there has been a tidal shift in sentiment about trade in the last couple of years. During the Clinton administration, of course, Clinton himself put pressure on Democrats to support NAFTA. Bush puts enormous pressure on Republicans. But a lot of these folks now, the Republicans, go back to the districts in the Midwest. They see industry after industry wiped out. They see good-paying jobs gone. They see the emergence of low-paying McDonald's or Walmart-type jobs. And even these guys are waking up and say, hey, you know what? We were sold a bill of goods. It just ain't working. So even the vote in the Senate, which obviously was not surprising, the Senate has historically been terrible on these agreements, was better than some had hoped from our perspective. As I think Amy indicated, the vote in the House is expected to be very close. And remember, we are doing better now in opposing unfettered free trade in this proposal than we have in the past. But corporate America is putting tremendous power, pressure on Congress. The president is now beginning to do what they always do, and that is work out little agreements with this group or that group, bring people into the White House. I'm sure campaign contributions will be flowing to those people who are prepared to vote for it, and so forth and so on. But in the midst of all this, I know for a lot of listeners, this trade agreement or trade agreements in general are not a sexy issue. But people have got to appreciate that there is a reason why, despite the explosion of technology and the increase in worker productivity in the United States in the last 20 years, real wages are down. Poverty today is increasing. The gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. Today, two workers in a family, often a husband and wife, have less disposable income than one worker did 30 years ago. And one of the reasons for the decline of the middle class is these terrible trade agreements that force us to compete against desperate people abroad. People should know that in Central America, 40% of the workers there make less than $2 a day. And that's the competition that we're going to be engaged in. Also, I had the opportunity a couple of years ago. Charlie Kernaghan is the head of a group in New York City called the National Labor Committee, which does extraordinarily good work in exposing sweatshops all over the world. And he brought to Vermont some workers from Honduras, women, who were just described to us the kind of horrendous conditions that they had to work under. And does anybody think that in tiny, poor countries like Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, that workers are going to be able to stand up for their rights? It just ain't the case, and it's going to be a bad agreement for the people there and the people and workers in the United States.
Bernie Sanders, will have to leave it there. Congressmember from Vermont and Bama Thray, if people want to go to your website, though the Department of Labor said remove it, can they get the report that you did for them?
There is substantial data on Central American labor standards on our website, and that site is laborrights.org.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us as we wrap up today with, well, this weekend is July 4th, and a lot of people are firing up their grills in anticipation of those burger cookouts and barbecues. You might want to think twice about what you'll be eating, though, this weekend. Last week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced the second case of mad cow disease is found in the country. The previous case of the disease was found in a cow imported to Washington State from Canada. But on Wednesday, the department confirmed this cow was born and spent his entire life in the United States. So what does this mean for U.S. consumers of meat? We're joined on the line by John Stauber, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, author of Mad Cow USA. Could the nightmare happen here? What about it? What about this cow, John Stauber?
Well, clearly the nightmare is happening here, and what's going on in the United States is that the United States Department of Agriculture, the FDA, the meat and livestock industry are simply lying to the press and the American public when they say that we have in place the necessary measures to stop the spread of mad cow disease. The United States government is refusing to follow the lead of other countries which have successfully dealt with mad cow disease, such as Japan and the EU nations. And I think a lot of listeners are really in the dark, too, because the mainstream media, so beholden to advertising money from the big food conglomerates and the beef industry, have really not inform the public about the risks of mad cow disease to human health and our blood supply.
Oh,
Well, John, the amazing thing to me about this story was that supposedly this cow, the first inkling that the government had of mad cow in this cow was last November, and it was not confirmed until the end of June. And also that the cow was, I think, a 12-year-old cow in Texas, which means it was born while George Bush was governor of Texas. But your response to the long delay in trying to ascertain whether this cow indeed did have mad cow disease.
I think we need a criminal investigation here of the way this animal was handled. Last November, mid-November, the U.S. Department of Agriculture conducted what are called rapid tests looking for mad cow disease on this suspect animal. And indeed, in two of the rapid tests, this animal showed positive for mad cow disease. And everyone who was paying close attention thought, well, this is it. Here's mad cow disease in Texas. The U.S. Department of Agriculture shipped samples after incinerating the carcass. They shipped samples of the brain to their lab in Ames, Iowa. Now, the manufacturer of these rapid tests said the odds of this cow having mad cow disease were probably around 250,000 to 1 after showing positive on two rapid tests. But the USDA tested the cow at its laboratory in Ames, Iowa, and guess what? This was the 1 in 250,000. They said this cow does not have mad cow disease. Immediately, organizations like Consumers Union and their staff scientist, Dr. Michael Hansen, got on the U.S. Department of Agriculture and said, well, what test did you do? Did you do the internationally recognized gold standard test, the Western blot test? And the U.S. Department of Agriculture hemmed and hawed, but finally admitted they didn't do the Western blot test, which would have cleared up any confusion. And in March, actually sent Consumers Union a letter saying, we're not doing the Western blot test because it wouldn't provide us any useful information. Well, what finally happened was Dr. Hansen continued to raise this in scientific circles, and the inspector general, the investigative arm inside the USDA, actually went around the secretary, got the Western blot test done a few weeks ago, and guess what? This cow, killed 7 months ago, was positive for mad cow disease. We need a criminal investigation of what went on here.
You write in your book, Mad Cow USA, John Stauber, about this popular Texas bumper sticker that reads, "The only mad cow in America is Oprah." Let's not forget that she was sued by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. You write, at the encouragement of the current governor of Texas, Rick Perry, she took her show down to Texas while she went through the suit, though she ultimately won under Texas's so-called crime of beef disparagement when she said she wanted to eat a burger on her show.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of irony with this first found homegrown mad cow being from Texas. You know, this is a horrific fatal dementia disease. 160 people are dead worldwide. We don't know how many thousands of people might be incubating it. It sits invisible in people for decades. It's contaminated the blood supply. So this is a very serious and mysterious ailment. And in March 20th, 1996, the British government, finally after a decade of denial, said, oh, we are wrong. The disease is spreading from cattle into people. There were 10 young people dying. Well, the current governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who was the agriculture commissioner at the time, responded to the announcement that people were dying from mad cow disease by holding a publicity stunt, cooking up a barbecue for the press, and ridiculing the idea that this could ever occur in the United States or was any real risk to human health. Today, Rick Perry, of course, is the governor of Texas.
We're going to have to leave it there.
Having to eat his words.
Well, I want to thank you very much, John Stauber, for joining us, brwatch.org, the website. That does it for today's broadcast. I'm looking forward tonight to being with our technical director, Angel Alston, Rosendale, New York, talking about the meaning of patriotism as a benefit for Kids Beat and Listen With Your Eyes. Be there with Larry Beinhart, who did the movie Wag the Dog. That does it for today's broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, and Nell Geiser. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can get transcripts of the show. You can watch or listen to any part that you missed and send it on to friends. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Have a good holiday weekend.